supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Today, potential jurors for Bill Cosby's upcoming criminal sexual assault retrial answered questions about their ability to be fair and impartial. WHYY's Laura Benchoff joins us from the Montgomery County Courthouse to give us a rundown of the day's events. So, Laura, what kind of questions did Judge Stephen O'Neill pose to potential jurors?
So this was the first day of jury selection, and Judge O'Neill seated 120 potential jurors in the main courtroom in the Montgomery County Courthouse at the beginning of the day and started asking them questions about who they know who might be affiliated with the case. So that's law enforcement or attorneys, their familiarity with Bill Cosby himself. But the bulk of the questions had to do with how much familiarity people had with the case itself, the accusations against Bill Cosby, and things like other accusations of sexual assault against high-profile men. Had they heard of the Me Too movement generally? So out of that pool of 120, only 10 potential jurors indicated by raising cards with their juror number on them that they had never heard about the case. And nearly 70 raised their numbered cards when asked if they'd already formed an opinion about whether or not Cosby is guilty. They were also asked about their own experience with sexual assault, and close to 40 said they or a close family member had been the victim of sexual assault.
Sounds like a lot of people were winnowed down here. Based on their answers, how many are still left?
So that's right. There are far fewer people who are being called back from that original 120 tomorrow. Lawyers agreed to exclude dozens of potential jurors, only deciding to call back around 27 for more questioning. But they did pick one juror. We don't know his name. He's a youngish white guy, appeared to be maybe in his late 20s or early 30s. He said that he had not heard of the allegations against Cosby, but he had heard about the Me Too movement. But he said he didn't think that anything he'd read about it in the news would affect his ability to decide a verdict based only on the facts of the case.
So the judge looking for jurors in a pool that really don't want to serve on a sequestered jury had a little inducement for them. Tell us about that.
You could say he had an inducement. He made a point of saying, you know, if you're picked for this jury, you're going to be sequestered. So you're going to be kind of cut off from your normal life. But we will put you in a very nice hotel, which he said several times. And he also mentioned that there are a few outstanding motions that he has not ruled on yet that will really shape what evidence comes into the trial. And he plans to drop all of those as soon as business hours start tomorrow morning. So we're going to have a lot more information first thing tomorrow morning about what the case is going to look like, what the trial is going to look like.
Thank you, WHYY's Laura Benchoff. We know you'll be bringing us updates throughout the Cosby trial.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Would it alarm you to hear 100,000 people registered to vote in Pennsylvania aren't even citizens? Gubernatorial candidate and state senator Scott Wagner says it's true, and he's been campaigning on the issue. WHYY's Dave Davies looked into where that number comes from.
The claim that 100,000 non-citizens are registered was trumpeted in a February article in the Washington Times, and Republican Wagner has repeated it in email appeals to supporters. He was asked after a recent campaign event what he'd say to those who are skeptical.
Well, I would say that they should prove it otherwise. Burden of proof is on them to prove that number is not accurate. We think it is.
Even Wagner wasn't sure where the count came from, but it's not a mystery. It turns out that for nearly 20 years, Pennsylvania's Department of Transportation's system all but encouraged non-citizens to register to vote and registered them. When a non-citizen would go to get a driver's license, he or she would show a green card or other documents making it clear he or she wasn't a citizen.
And then is immediately at that point in time asked, would you like to register to vote?
That's Philadelphia City Commissioner Al Schmidt at a state Senate hearing, pointing out a flaw in PennDOT's implementation of the National Motor Voter Law.
Certainly most people who did that did not intentionally go to PennDOT that day setting out to commit voter fraud.
That problem of PennDOT touchscreens routinely offering voter registration to non-citizens was fixed last year. But how many non-citizens were registered from all those years when they were misled into believing it was okay? Schmidt says there's a way to check. Voter registration records include driver's license numbers, and driver's licenses of non-citizens have an INS indicator for Immigration and Naturalization Service. You can run a match between those two databases.
It's not a matter of guessing. It's a direct match. They're unique numbers tied to those records.
Schmidt says officials of the Department of State, which oversees elections, told him last summer they ran that match and found over 100,000 hits. That's where the number comes from. Officials from the Department of State will neither confirm nor deny that they did that computer match, but they've said the 100,000 figure is not credible. Two veteran immigration lawyers say they've encountered non-citizens who registered to vote, but not many.
I've been practicing for 10 years, exclusively immigration law, and I've seen it twice, maybe.
That's attorney Brennan Giangrasso, who's skeptical about the 100,000 figure. If it were true, it would amount to about 30% of the non-citizens of voting age living in the state, according to Census Bureau estimates. There's no evidence that large numbers of non-citizens have actually voted. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Tax season is one of the most dreaded times of the year, and scammers take advantage of that to trick unsuspecting people into giving them money. The IRS estimates more than $65 million has been lost because of phone tax scams. These schemes are most common during March and April, where reporter Paige Flager found out firsthand when her phone rang.
The voice on the other end of the line said he was calling from the Pennsylvania State Police. He rattled off some information about me, my full name, my email address, where I went to college, when I graduated, and told me the IRS had a warrant out for my arrest for not paying taxes on my college scholarship. I told him the whole thing sounded fishy, and this was his response.
Can you see my phone number, ma'am, appearing on your cell phone right now?
Yes.
Okay, I just want you to go and just type in the whole number online and see which office and which department you're speaking to right now at this moment.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I'm seeing that that's the Pennsylvania State Police number. He then told me that I could make the whole thing go away by buying Apple gift cards, which was when I realized it was a scam. But not everyone is so lucky.
Right now, if I wanted to get a loan, I can't, you know, because my credit right now is not that great.
That's Michelle Albitz of Bartow, Pennsylvania. She pulled more than $10,000 out of her credit cards last year when she fell victim to a tax scam just like mine. She got the call when she was at work.
And it said that this was the IRS. I owed money, and if I did not call back this number, the local authorities would be after me.
Albitz was one of 52 people in Pennsylvania who fell for a tax scam last year. In 2017, scammers tricked more than $356,000 out of Pennsylvania residents, according to the IRS.
A lot of people are afraid of the IRS. And so when you hear those words, when someone calls, I think it intimidates a lot of folks on the receiving end of the phone call.
That's Ed Wirth, a special agent on the Criminal Investigation Division at the IRS. The Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration has been tracking these phone scams since 2013, and Pennsylvania is ranked 9th in the country in terms of dollars lost.
We have a loss of around $1.8 million, with total victims of 398.
Worth says that phone scams can be spotted because they're sudden, and the request will seem really urgent.
So if you want to resolve the matter, this should be right now, right away.
Often, they'll threaten legal action, like arrest or deportation. And in order to make the problem go away, they'll request personal information or money.
Well, if you want to resolve the matter, ma'am, your first step is you have to go to the government-certified store or government-certified location, ma'am, and you have to purchase a federal bond for the amount of $7,980.
As technology evolves, so have tax scams. Con artists can make any number appear on your caller ID, which is how they made it look like they were calling me from the state police number, and how they can even make it look like they're calling from the real IRS number. That can make these scams confusing, but Ed Wirth from the IRS says people just need to remember one simple rule.
If you have not received communication from us via the U.S. mail, we're not going to be calling you.
He urges people to not let fear of the tax man make you the next victim of a tax scam. For WHYY News, Paige Flager.
One of Philadelphia's historic sites, the Eastern State Penitentiary, is as iconic as it is eerie. A crumbling monument to a 19th century model of criminal justice and moral reform. More than 150 years ago, two inmates at Eastern State, a white woman and a black man, carried on a secret affair inside those walls. Letters covertly sent between them are now archived at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. A historian formerly at Villanova University, now a doctoral candidate at the College of William and Mary in Virginia, has written about those letters and says they're evidence of an underground resistance against prevailing social norms. WHYY's Peter Crimmins spoke with Rebecca Capobianco about love behind bars.
Most people think of Eastern State Penitentiary as this Halloween attraction because it's such a creepy building. It was designed to be isolating. It had this great moral correction mission. What was Eastern State Penitentiary designed to do?
It was supposed to resemble something like a monastery with vaulted ceilings and fairly large dimensions, one prisoner per cell. And the idea was that the building itself would actually kind of reform prisoners from within. The initial architects of the prison believed that people were inherently moral, or basically moral at least, and that they were corrupted by outside influences. So if you could remove those influences and sort of give people that opportunity to reflect on their lives and their behaviors, that they would naturally sort of correct their paths.
So you could go your whole sentence, however long you're, if you were an inmate, you could go your whole sentence without ever seeing another inmate.
Right. Well, at least ideally, that's what they told people.
So I want to bring in one inmate that you write about, Elizabeth Valora Elwell, who entered the prison in 1861, I believe.
Yes. We don't know a lot about Elizabeth Elwell. She shows up in the census record once before her incarceration at Eastern State. When she is, she identifies herself as a 17-year-old woman. The prison identifies her as a white woman. She's been convicted of larceny. She was a first-time offender.
She meets another inmate named Jackson.
Yes.
What do we know about Jackson?
Yeah, so Albert Green Jackson, he is actually African-American. He's also a first-time offender. He had already been in prison for over a year.
And they strike up a relationship. As you say, we only know the relationship through these letters, and the letters are basically love letters. They're between people who are affectionate and even intimate with one another. Something that is strictly against the rules of the prison.
Yes, absolutely.
What do we know about their relationship? What can we glean from these letters about their relationship?
Sure. So one thing that seems very clear from the letters is that they weren't just corresponding through writing, but they were actually seeing each other on a very regular basis. Elizabeth writes about talking to him through a doorway and a gate. And then she has various comments about meeting him in the coal cellar and hoping for a day when they won't have to sneak around.
And in the paper you wrote, you quote one of the letters. I wonder if you could read it for us. What, give us a taste of what was in these letters.
Sure. So on April 25th, my dear, I am most dead every night when I come up to the old cell and leave you, my dear honey. May we see the time, my dear, that we will not have to go back to the coal cellar to talk one word.
The letters are one way because we only have, you know, one set of letters. We don't have letters in response. We do have one, though, that Albert Jackson wrote a poem to Elizabeth, Lizzie, as he calls her. Can you give us a sense of what Jackson was writing in response?
Sure. He writes, "My Lizzie dwelleth in my heart and mind, my beautiful young bride and wife. She is the beauty of this place, my dear sweet bride, Elizabeth."
These letters between Elizabeth and Jackson, how do you read them? What do they say about the institution's attempt to reform and morally correct inmates?
I think one of the primary things that it tells us is the subordinate role that women played in the prison. Women who had been convicted of crimes are viewed as less capable of reform than men are. And because of that, they are sort of in a way excluded from the whole reform process.
If you have a fallen woman, you can't bring her back? Is that what they were thinking?
Right, yeah, that she's essentially fallen too far from grace. But it also tells us, I think, a lot about this anxiety that people are feeling about changes in the social landscape of the nation, that despite their efforts at places like Eastern State to control and contain it, they can't. Even inside this place that is supposed to be overpowering of individuals, controlling their behavior, that people are changing their ideas and they're behaving the way that they want to and they're creating relationships that they want to. And there's not a whole lot that the state can really do.
One of the things that makes these letters so interesting and in a way kind of charming, Elizabeth, we can sort of show her as something of a minor revolutionary. She's attempting to subvert a system that is trying to suppress her, a prison. But she's not someone who stages protests or marches or takes up arms or something. She's simply someone who fell in love with someone else.
Right.
But it was in the wrong place, and it was with the wrong man.
Yeah, I definitely see her that way. And as historians, we are always looking for the ways that people are influencing courses of events on the small scale of their individual lives and individual relationships, and viewing that as something that can really collectively make an impact on the future of the nation.
I'm speaking with Rebecca Capobianco. She's a PhD candidate at the College of William Mary in Virginia, and she has just written about the love letters of Elizabeth Valora Elwell, an inmate at Eastern State Penitentiary. Thanks so much for talking to me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
The letters of Elizabeth Elwell are archived at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. Good things have happened in Texas for Villanova's men's basketball team in recent years. Nova fans and those connected with the program feel it's a lucky location. For WHYY, Greg Eklund reports ahead of tonight's championship game.
In his 17th season for the Wildcats, coaching in his 39th NCAA tournament game, Jay Wright.
It was a good night all the way around on Saturday since the introductions. As Wildcats coach Jay Wright thought about all the Villanova fans in attendance, he was also struck by the absence of one of the Wildcats' biggest boosters. Wright laments not seeing former head coach Raleigh Massimino, who died last year.
I miss it a lot, personally. We have his whole family. I think we have 18 Massiminos here, and his grandson's on our staff, so there's always going to be a piece of Coach Massimino in this program.
Matt Massimino is a graduate manager for this year's team. Wright says during the 2016 Final Four in Houston, he could always know, even from a distance, when Coach Massimino was around.
In the hotel, I can hear when the crowd's going crazy, and I know he walked in.
Among the fans attending the game tonight is TJ Suzuki of Philadelphia, who will be in the stands with friends Ann Connolly and John Sacco.
None of us made the trip last time, and basically after they won the championship, then basically were saying we're never going to miss it again. So here we are.
They're hoping for more good Texas memories in tonight's title game against the Michigan Wolverines. Tip-off is 9:20 Villanova time. For WHYY, Greg Eklund.
You may have heard the word henge before, but what does it mean? It's defined as a prehistoric monument consisting of a circle of stone or wooden uprights. Well, move over, Stonehenge. According to Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, Philadelphia will feature a sort of henge of its own this Friday. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller spoke with Pitts for more details.
Derek, I'll meet you on Market Street.
Bring your circle of stones or wooden plinths or something, and we'll see what we can do. Well, you know, this idea of Stonehenge is something that has always captivated people's imagination, because how was it possible for ancient civilizations, ancient societies like Druids and others who lived in Western Europe to create what seemed to be very accurate astronomical calendars using gigantic stones placed out on the landscape?
So these were sundials that weighed tons.
These were tons for sure, but rather than being the kind of sundial that looked at the passage of time during the day, they actually kept track of the passage of time in the course of a year. Well, you know, it's possible to do that in an urban environment also, and without bringing your own stones or pieces of wood and needing a permit to do this. A number of cities are laid out in grid patterns. And if the grid pattern is oriented correctly, it gives you an opportunity to observe the rising position or the setting position of the sun on specific dates. the north-south streets of Philadelphia, i.e. Broad Street and Market Street, are not directly laid out according to astronomical east-west. We can get half and half occasionally, like the sun rising at the end of one street on one day, but setting at the end of a different street another day, simply because of this odd offset. So I chose to try to calculate this using Market Street as a main east-west street. Now, because we're off actual north-south, east-west by about 9 degrees, here's what happens. We can see the sun as it rises, looking east down Market Street on February 28th at about 6:35 in the morning. However, sunset, looking down Market Street west, we can actually see the sun right at the end of the street this Friday at about 7:30 p.m. This is something, though, that almost everyone can do, no matter where they live. If you think you have an east-west street that might fit this pattern, you can figure this out for yourself to create your own fill-in-the-blank hinge of where you live for any time during the course of the year.
So that's Friday sunset, and when the sun drops and the skies get nice and dark, what's available to be seen in the night sky?
So much great stuff. Let's start with constellations first. The spring constellations have now moved into prominence in the evening sky at about 10 p.m. If we start over on the western side of the sky, we can see the last of the winter constellations, Taurus, Orion, and Gemini, nice and bright over on the western side of the sky. If we come around to the south, we'll find that Leo, the constellation Leo the Lion, is in what I call the keystone position. That's about halfway up the sky. At about 10 p.m. in the evening, halfway between east and west, you're looking south, you'll find Leo right there. The interesting thing is that as you look at this group of stars, it actually looks like the shape of a lion. A backwards question mark on the left side of this. You remember we're looking toward the south. And then to the right of that backwards question mark, we see a triangle of stars pointed to the east. That triangle marks the back end of the lion. The backwards question mark marks the head and the mane of the lion. Well, if you imagine between the head and the tail of the lion, there's the back. If you look directly above that, you'll see the Big Dipper. It's an easy way to find the Big Dipper.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
And that's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.